This past Friday was the monthly Senior Saints Luncheon. It was at the Thousand Oaks congregation. And instead of having a speaker, we just sang and had folks call out the song numbers and names of the songs that they wanted to sing. And as we were in process of that, Phil Wall made the comment that this coming Sunday was going to be Mother's Day. He said, "There isn't a Mother's Day song, is there?" And without dropping a beat, his wife Lois said, "To God be the glory." Well, it was funny if you'd been there. As I was preparing for this morning's sermon from Proverbs 31 about mothers as noble women, I noticed in verse 20 of that chapter that it says of such a woman, "She opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy." That really shouldn't be surprising, because at the time that Solomon wrote those things, or that King Lemuel wrote those things, at the time all of those sayings that are found in Proverbs were collected, there had been a long and rich history of God's teachings about the poor and the needy. If you look in Leviticus chapter 25, and there in verses 35 through 38, God gave instructions to Israel about the treatment of one among them who is unable to support himself. And he told Israel this: "If one of your countrymen becomes poor and is unable to support himself among you, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident, so he can continue to live among you. Do not take interest of any kind from him, but fear your God, so that your countrymen may continue to live among you. You must not lend him money at interest or sell him food at a profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God." It's interesting how God had some standards there about how people were to live and about how people were to be treated. And it seems that this comment about God bringing them out of the land of Egypt and giving them the land of Canaan was to say, you need to be sensitive to and compassionate toward those among you, whether you're countrymen, whether aliens, or whether temporary residents, that you treat them with the same kind of care and compassion that I treated you when you were poor. At the outset of this series, we read from Deuteronomy chapter 15 and verses 7 through 11, where Moses reminded Israel of God's teachings about caring for the poor among them. And in verse 11, Moses says, "There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your brothers and toward the poor and needy in your land." There will always be poor people in the land. That's true, if we stop and think about it, for every land or nation that has ever existed. Recently, my mother gave me a magazine from 1974 that my father had saved. I was curious why he'd saved it until I found his picture in it. But the featured article in that magazine is entitled "Crisis in America: Poverty." And it focused on the reasons for poverty in the United States in 1974. And as I read through the article, I found it really curiously interesting that the reasons for poverty as they perceived them in 1974 are essentially the same reasons for it today in 2008, 34 years later. And yet, today, poverty in America is greater than it was 34 years ago. In Mark 14 and verse 7, Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them anytime you want." I've known some Christians who have interpreted Jesus' remark there to mean that caring for the poor is spiritually unimportant. Because after all, they're always going to be here. And frankly, the attitude that many have taken seems to be they're a bunch of deadbeats anyway. And, you know, it's as my father used to say so much that it became ingrained in me, poor people have poor ways. There's a lot of truth to that. The trouble is that when we take kind of a cynical attitude toward Jesus' remark and toward the presence of the poor, we overlook Jesus' abundant teachings about treatment of the poor and of the needy throughout Luke's gospel. I think we should remember, too, that Jesus' recorded healings were primarily to poor people. In that era, to have some kind of impairment, such as being lame or blind or deaf, or to have some sort of debilitating disease, would cause a person to be poor because they could no longer work for a living. They had no social safety nets to provide for them other than family, and that was if they had family. A unique emphasis in Luke's gospel is Jesus' teaching about the rich and the poor. It is true that some rich people followed Jesus, but it is also true when we begin looking carefully that Jesus seemed to be closest to the poor. We seem to read more about him spending more time with the poor than with the wealthy. And it was not a discrimination of poor and wealth. It seemed to have to do perhaps with the idea that the poor openly recognized their needs and their inability to take care of themselves perhaps as those wealthier did. Or it may have been because care for the poor reflects God's heart, his concern for them. I'd like to ask you to open to Luke's gospel tonight and kind of walk with me, if you will, through a variety of encounters and teachings that we find in Luke's gospel. Luke's gospel is unique in the focus that it has on Jesus' encounters with and teachings about the poor and the needy. Before Jesus' birth, we encounter his mother, Mary, singing a song of praise there in Luke chapter 1 and in verses 46 through 55. Particularly of interest to the thoughts that we're going to be looking at tonight is verse 53 in that song, where Mary says of God, "He has filled the hungry with good things, but he has sent the rich away empty." Now, certainly we can interpret that as meaning spiritually being filled. But that's not exactly what it says, and that's not necessarily what it means. 30 years later, in chapter 4, as we see Jesus beginning his ministry, we find there in chapter 4, Jesus has entered into the synagogue there in Nazareth. And we find that Jesus is participating in the activities that go on in the synagogue. And so beginning with verse 17, it says, "The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, 'The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor.'" It goes on to say that then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Jesus identified himself with the Messiah of Isaiah chapter 61 and verses 1 and 2, from which this reading is taken, as well as with another passage that's found in Isaiah, chapter 58 and verses 6 through 10, where God speaks through Isaiah to his people. And he says to them with great dismay, "Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke? To set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe him and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? Then your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and the Lord will say, 'Here am I.' If you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing finger and malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will become like the noonday." It's interesting how there is such a close relationship in concepts between what Jesus quoted in chapter 61 and what's said by God back here in chapter 58. Back in Luke chapter 4, and there in verses 25 through 27, Jesus reminded those in the synagogue of God's compassion toward all people, Jews or not, brothers or not, by saying, "I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet. Yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." Chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, tells of Jesus and his disciples going through the grain fields on the Sabbath and encountering objections from the Pharisees who were watching him closely so that they might have something to accuse him of and to discredit him. Jesus' response to them not only reminds them of biblical history, it also places people's needs above the law. In Luke 6, in verse 17 and following, it records Jesus' Sermon on the Plain. We often identify Jesus' Sermon on the Plain with Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and there are similarities, but there are also some very different approaches that are found here in Luke chapter 6 in that sermon, and they have to do with the focus. If you'll notice in chapter 6 and in verses 20 on through 26, Jesus looked at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven, for that is how their fathers treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that is how their fathers treated the false prophets." And then later on, in verses 32 on through verse 34, Jesus says, "If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full." Jesus seems to be addressing more this sense, whether directly or subtly, of concerns about people who in this life we're poor, we're hungry, we're in need. In chapter 9 of Luke, in verses 10 through 17, Jesus feeds 5,000 hungry people. In chapter 10, in verses 30 through 37, he tells about the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan who went out of his way, who risked his life, who gave up his time and money, and committed to give further time to help a person in need. And Jesus concludes that story by saying that this person, this Samaritan, truly loved his neighbor as himself. It's interesting that Jesus would use that kind of a situation to talk about loving one's neighbor. It would seem to be enough that he talks about a Samaritan doing something of good, but here is a situation where a person goes out of their way to do something for someone in need that really he knows nothing about. In chapter 12 again, in verses 16 through 21, Jesus tells of a rich fool who's been blessed by God, but only thinks of himself. And he's told by God that he'll die that day and lose all he has. Jesus says that the story concludes, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. And it seems that the unspoken thing here is sharing blessings with others. And there in chapter 12 and verses 42, through 48, impressing the necessity of readiness for his return, Jesus pictures a chief servant in his master's employ. And he says, who then is the faithful and wise manager whom the master puts in charge of his servants to give them their food allowance at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whom the master finds doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose the servant says to himself, my master is taking a long time coming, and then begins to beat the men servants and maid servants and to eat and drink and get drunk. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. That servant, who knows his master's will and does not get ready or does not do what his master wants, will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Again, it's interesting that as Jesus pictures the wise and the unwise servant, the faithful and the unfaithful servant, he chooses to include this aspect of providing food to those who he's in charge of. Something that would seem would not have to be included here for the story and for the message to get across, and yet Jesus chooses to include that concept. In chapter 14, in verses 12 through 14, Jesus urges wealthy people to invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind to their banquets instead of those who can repay them in kind. And he then shows, in verses 15 through 24, God doing the very same thing. In 1998, Dr. Gary Hamlin, an osteopath, opened a new medical practice just outside Joplin, Missouri. It was a medical practice where any patient who needed medical care received it. No one was turned over to a collection agency for non-payment. Medicare and Medicaid assignments were welcomed. 35 to 40 patients came to his clinic each day, Monday through Friday. And in order to pay his overhead, Dr. Hamlin moonlighted every other weekend in a local hospital. After this had gone on for a while, he was interviewed and asked what had caused him to open such a practice. And he replied, Luke 14:14 introduced me to the founding principle of this clinic. It was God's personal promise to me. It said, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Dr. Hamlin realized the idea of a greater reward for helping people in need. If we continue in Luke in chapter 16, in verses 19 through 31, Jesus tells of a rich man living in luxury. And interestingly enough, as we read through this story, this rich man is never given a name. Because we also read about a hungry, sore-covered beggar at the rich man's gate, a man who is given a name, the name of Lazarus. This rich man and this poor man are not worlds apart. It's not as though the rich man lives on the good side of town and the poor man, this beggar, sore-covered beggar, lives across town. This sore-covered beggar, Lazarus, is at the gate of the rich man's house. Every time the rich man goes out his door and comes back in, he cannot miss the sight and the condition of this poor man. And for his lack of compassion toward the beggar, when the rich man died, he's pictured as having gone to hell. Again, it's interesting that Jesus chooses to present this kind of picture for us that is so clear and so unavoidable in its purposes. In Luke chapter 18, in verses 18 through 32, Jesus calls for a rich man to sell his possessions, give the proceeds to the poor, and to come follow him. But the rich man simply could not part with his riches, regardless of the benefits that it might derive to others and to himself. In Luke 19, and verses 1 through 10, when Zacchaeus, a wealthy man, is moved by Jesus' teachings, he commits to give half his possessions to the poor. Half of his possessions to the poor. Why would he say this? Was it because he had a guilty conscience for what he had not done for the poor? Was it because of what Jesus had taught him about his need to reach out to the poor? We don't know. Nothing is said one way or the other. All we know is that Zacchaeus is called out of a tree by Jesus. Jesus says, I'm coming to your house tonight for dinner. The next thing we know, the dinner is there, and Zacchaeus stands up and makes this proclamation. Something has happened in this man's life. Whether guilt or whether further teaching, God has worked on this man's heart. In Luke 21, in verses 1 through 4, Jesus turns his teachings to the poor. Observing a woman who gave out of her poverty all she had to God. And she did it in trust of his care. Then in chapter 23, and in verses 50 through 53, we come to see something that's easy to overlook on the one hand, and yet I'm persuaded God intends that we not overlook it. On one occasion, in Luke, Jesus reminds would-be followers that following him would not be easy. And he says in one place there that the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to put his head. Even though it's hard, I'm sure, for us to imagine, for all intents and purposes, Jesus was homeless. Oh, sure, he could have gone back and lived with his mother and brothers and sisters there back in his hometown, but he did not. And we know that he kind of had a central place that he continually returned to. That was Capernaum. But we never read of Jesus having a house or an apartment in a house. We just read about Jesus being there. And then Jesus making this comment about not having a place to lay his head. And so, when we get to Luke chapter 23 and verses 50 through 53, we encounter Jesus having been crucified and dying and being taken off the cross. And then a question has to arise suddenly. What are we going to do with this impoverished man? Well, there was a place where people in his condition normally were put. It's called Potter's Field. Jesus was poor. He didn't have the wealth to even afford a place to be buried. And so God provided a wealthy man to take care of the needs of materially poor Jesus. Materially poor Jesus is taken care of by a materially wealthy man by the name of Joseph. From before his birth, through his teachings, and into his death, care of the poor and the needy was emphasized repeatedly by Jesus. Applying his teachings about care of these would bless the giver and the receiver and the community, and it would glorify God. The story is told of a little boy who heard his father pray for the hungry, the tired, and the poor. And after the prayer, the boy said to his father, "I wish I had your money, Daddy." And his father kind of looked at him with curiosity, and he said, "Why? What would you do with it?" And the little boy replied, "I would answer your prayer." James chapter 4 and verse 17 says, "Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins." And in 1 John chapter 3 and in verses 16 through 20, the Apostle John says to us, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. This then is how we know that we belong to the truth, and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence, whenever our hearts condemn us. For God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything." Jesus is our model of love in action to all people. Openly sharing our material things with others is a sign of God's love in us. And God, as John says, knows our hearts, whether or not we have a heart for the needy. I think the ultimate question that this riot raises for us tonight is, are our hearts aligned with the heart of God, who had and maintains this great heart for the poor and the needy, for those sometimes who are the marginalized of society? Is our heart aligned with God? If in any way that question applies to you, then we would be honored to be of help to you tonight, to come back to God or to come to God, but in any case, to have your heart aligned with the heart of God. If we might help you, we urge you to come forward right now as we stand and sing this song.